Thank you, and thank you, Dr. Belcourt. I think Dr. Belcourt has set me up very nicely for this presentation. So, again, my name is Cynthia Pearson. I'm an associate professor with the Indigenous Wellness Research Institute at the University of Washington, and I'd like to first state that I have no relationships to disclose. The overview of my presentation today is I'm going to talk a little bit about our institute, and that's IWRI, Erie, not like woo scary Erie, but Indigenous Wellness Research Institute, and American Indian Alaska Native Communities. I'm going to talk a little bit about why we're conducting community-engaged research, and I think there's where Dr. Belcourt had really laid the ground, so I'll kind of go over that a little faster than I had originally proposed. And then I'm going to talk specifically, and this is just of this presentation today, is about the documents to promote responsible conduct of research in Indian country, given that some of the historical breaches that have taken place. And specifically, I'm going to discuss data sharing agreements and research and publication guidelines, and then I'm going to follow with some recommendations. So first, a little bit about our institute and who we are. We were established in 2005 by two Indigenous scholars, Dr. Karina Walters and Dr. Tessa Evans Campbell. And our mission is really to marshal the resources of community, tribal, and government and academics to come together to address some of the health disparities across Indian country, and to not only identify the risk factors, but more importantly, the resiliency and strength factors in these communities. We partner with over 250 tribal communities, and we have implemented over 40 NIH and foundation-funded grants, and they're growing by the day. Why community engage research with American Indian Alaskan Native communities? Well, as Dr. Belcourt had indicated, there are over 567 federally recognized tribes and thousands others as state and unrecognized tribes across the United States. And with the federally recognized tribes, they have sovereign status. So as she indicated, they are nations within a nation, and they have the rights and the responsibilities to govern the activities that take place on their tribal lands. Furthermore, as given the historical and ongoing breaches in ethical research, these communities are expecting and demanding that they be brought to the table and engaged in the research process at every phase. And in doing so, this ensures research is responsible to ethical requirements and community health concerns. As an outside researcher, you may not be actually understand the risk and the benefits that research may bring to a community. Having those tribal partners at the table allows that door to open and that Indigenous knowledge to come to the forefront and to guide the research practices. And community engaged research also helps you assess community level risks that could occur from the research process. So in doing so, what our institute has done and a few others is develop these specialized data sharing agreements and guidelines. So we did a content analysis for over eight research studies looking at their data sharing agreements and their research protocols. So of those eight, five were from one-site studies, three from the Pacific Northwest, Southwest, and Midwest, two from were multi-site, so there were six and eight sites across the United States, and one was a national study, and they were four epidemiological studies and four randomized controlled trials. So we looked at the common elements across these. So looking specifically at the data sharing agreements, we identified 10 elements. One of the first elements was the purpose of the data sharing agreement. And across the board, it was to protect the people, the culture, and the natural resources of the communities, and also to prevent from any unauthorized data sharing from this research. And again, as Dr. Belcourt had pointed out, as is in the case of the Pasufai, some researchers were taking the data, they were taking it under one pretense, and it was being analyzed and used for another, often naming communities and stigmatizing large groups of people. So data sharing agreements are to really kind of lay out those boundaries and to protect these incidents from occurring or these breaches from occurring. And it also to ensure that research recognizes the sovereignty, tribal sovereignty, and that the tribe has oversight and they are stewards of all the data that is gathered from their lands and from their peoples. And it also establishes and provides the study data sharing expectations and responsibilities. And the next couple of elements, it gets a little bit more into the detail and the nuts and bolts of how the data is shared. Specifically, one of the first elements is describe the length of the actual agreement, what the reporting criteria is, to who, what is, and how often reporting takes place to a certain committee. Supporting documents, so if there are publication agreements or research guidelines, the data sharing agreement will point to those as supplemental documents. Describes the purpose of the research that is being taken place as well as the goals. And then for the agreement stipulation, it really lays out who the parties are, who are the responsible people that we call to the table, and who the funders are, as well as identifying a termination date. This is really important to say how long the agreement goes, when it should be renewed, and how frequently the agreement should be assessed. The next couple of elements, they really go into detail about the data collection activities. It identifies the partner's roles as it pertains to data collection. So this is a whole list of activities that take place during data collection. So it really says who does what. When you're conducting community-engaged research, it's not that everybody comes and everybody does everything, because not everyone has all the same skills. But it is keeping all the partners informed and engaged in that process. So who is going to take the lead in submitting the IRB protocols? Who's going to take the lead in collecting the data and cleaning it or compiling it? And so it just really breaks that down quite clearly. For data storage and access, element 6 was the type of data that was going to be collected and how it is actually stored and who has access it and at what level. So who has access to the raw data, who has access to the aggregate data, and what does that look like? Data use. This is, again, and this is actually a really important concept, is that data is collected for the aims of the grant, and it's tribally sanctioned, and then it identifies the dissemination activities. We'll talk about dissemination activities a little more in detail when we get to those agreements. So in elements 7 and 8, it talks about sharing responsibility, who the data can be shared with, and in what manner it can be shared, the process for sharing. So if before I bring anything to a conference, I take it to the community, they review the presentation, and it also outlines kind of timelines and who's at the table to do that review process. And then also if there's any breaches in those agreements, what are the repercussions for those? It talks a little bit also, too, about the general dissemination. It points to the research and publication guidelines, if they exist. Sometimes it's actually written right into the data sharing agreement. And then it agrees to co-author, okay, and this is where sometimes often researchers are a little concerned about, like if you're giving over, if the rights of the data belongs to the tribe, how do you also make sure that you publish according to your NIH funders agreement. And then, so there's a line in there that actually speaks that you agree to co-author and publish at minimum products per the aims of the grant. So right at the very beginning, before any data is collected, there's the discussion about publications and the expectations that will occur. Finally, in element 9 through 10, we talk about the data protection, what protections are in place, and how does that look, and then the general responsibility of the tribe. Here again, that the tribe is the steward of all cultural and tribal resources. And the next group are the research and publication guidelines. Here, there's 5 primary elements that kind of came to the forefront. The background really talks about, well, why do we have a research guidelines? What are the purpose of it? And you would see that the purpose for the research and publication guidelines is similar to the data sharing agreement, and that is to protect from unauthorized sharing and to reduce the adverse effects and also recognize tribal sovereignty. For elements 2 and 3 of the research guidelines, policy statements, really putting forth the rights of self-determination of the tribe, that they, again, are the steward of the data. You've heard that this actually repeated multiple times throughout the agreements. So this keeps coming up. And then also the rights of the participants. So if there are any other materials that are being produced during the research process that aren't actually identified as research data, that's clearly called out, and those data belongs to the people who are creating them. And then what did the research aspire to? So it's a new way of doing research. What are the aspirations, the things that people aspire to, as well as the principles in which the research is engaged, which people engage in the research process. So it really comes from a place of goodness, respect, gratitude, and reverence for the data that you're being given. So it is a gift when you're conducting research and people give you these data to address the goodness for the community, and recognizing and holding that in honor. And to also realize that the research is being conducted to those who come before us and those yet to come. As also Dr. Belcourt pointed out in her presentation. And finally, some of the principles in which research is actually guided. So it takes a little twist in always finding the deficit model, but coming from a research from a point of strength and respect, and really thinking about how the data is analyzed, how the data is stored, how the data is given back to the community, how the data is actually disseminated within and outside of the community. And here are some of the principles that came up repetitively through the documents that we've reviewed. Finally, in element 5 under the research guidelines, is really, this is, gets into more detail, is the composition of the review committee. Get rid of that little guy. Looking at the research process administrations, so when there's going to be review of research, how often do they have the meetings? What are the duties of the people at those meetings? Who attends them? And if any new products come out of the research, like often the research is conducted and you'll have students participate in that, are there theses being developed out of it, dissertations, secondary analysis, anything that wasn't described in the original data sharing agreement as part of the aims of the grant, then that goes back before another review committee and they look and make a decision whether or not they're going to sanction that research. The next part is actually looking at so within the community committee, they negotiate the terms and condition of the projects. They establish any other publication and presentation guidelines. And they'll also make sure if the research starts taking a different turn, they'll bring those interested parties from the community to the table to also review that protocol and to gain agreement or to make changes in the direction of the research or the new proposal. A little more details into the publication guidelines, looking at the potential for a publication. So in the publication guidelines, the investigators and the community members come together and they start talking about what papers can possibly be developed out of it. And they identify those papers up front and who are the possible authors. That can expand and move, but that's actually to start the conversations about publications. The role of the lead authors, the criteria for authorship, student authorship, and then actually just the whole kind of parameters around authorship. I've also brought out handouts that really go into these in details, knowing that I wasn't going to get it all in 15 minutes, so they're available. And then finally looking at the publication submission process, even the timeline for submission. How soon do you have to get your materials to the community members for their review? And then if there's any editings and going back, looking at the preliminary review format, and then acknowledging the community, as Annie said, do you name the community? There's actually text in these documents that say how the community will be identified, how the funders will be identified. So if anybody's writing publications from that, they'll take those acknowledgments out and that becomes part of the documents. And then, and also signatures. So in recommendations is to develop the guidelines and the agreement templates early in the partnership. Usually when you're doing community engaged research, you are working well in advance before you even apply for those grants. At that time, start those agreements, start having those conversations about how the data is going to be shared, who's going to have access to the data, what are the publications going to look like. In the beginning of a partnership, you're usually in a halo period. You're kind of developing some trust, so getting these areas conversations on the on paper now. So when you do get funded or you start to apply for a grant, it's a matter of putting in the aims of the grant and coming together. Another thing that that does, it gets everybody on the same language, talking the same terms and understanding each other. But if you do that in the beginning and not when you're trying to get a grant out, or not after you once you get funding, because things change when the money comes in the door, you've done a lot of the hard work up front. And also you know, formalize the agreement, write it down, have it signed, and then revisit it frequently, because things do change, so at least on a yearly basis. All right, thanks.
Thank you.